Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 11th, 2014. This week on the show, maybe you've noticed your grocery bill creeping up. Milk, eggs, veggies, meat. What's going on with food inflation? Also, we're going to open up all your closets and cupboards and do a good old-fashioned spring cleaning of your finances. But first, there's a deadline headed this way, and fast. Tuesday is tax day, and maybe you're done, or you're trying like crazy to get everything in on time, or you've decided to hit the emergency button, also known as filing an extension. Maybe you're just plain freaking out. We called Kelly Phillips-Erb. She's a tax attorney based in Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Kelly.
Thanks for having me back.
At this point, either people have got their taxes done, or they're thinking, I gotta get an extension. But people may not know, even if you're filing an extension, you have got to pay your estimated taxes. How do you do that estimate? And what if you actually can't pay?
In terms of estimate, you know, there's no magic number. The IRS kind of, they want you to pay what you paid last year. I mean, that's a good rule of thumb. If nothing has changed remarkably, if you pay as much as you owed last year, you should be fine. So the penalties and the interest come when at the end of the extension, you still owe a bucket of money. So you want to try to approximate what you owe as much as possible. And, you know, it's kind of hit or miss, because even though we say things like try to pay what you think you'll owe, you know, there's always something that makes this year stand out a little different from last year, whether it's the tax brackets have changed, you had less in medical expenses, you sold a house, you know, it could be anything. So, you know, you try your best is what you do. If you can't pay, I mean, the IRS actually has a lot of options for making that work. You can enter into an installment agreement. You can pay a little bit now and pay a little bit later. Taxpayers shouldn't be frightened of making partial payments. It's not the end of the world to have a little bit of penalty and interest. And nobody wants penalty and interest, and your tax preparer will tell you that's an evil, terrible thing. But, you know, if you can't pay, on some level you can't pay. I mean, there are also other options that you could consider. You can put it on a credit card, for example. But, you know, it's really easy to say put it on a credit card if you don't have room on the credit card. You know, obviously, you know, that's not going to work. I know the IRS likes to say things like maybe you could take out a line of equity on your house. I mean, those can be pretty drastic measures if you only owe a little bit. So my best advice is always pay what you can and try to work out a payment plan to pay the rest. And don't panic about it.
How does a partial payment plan work anyway?
The IRS actually has an installment agreement online. You can actually never have to speak to a person about what you owe or your financials or anything that you don't want to talk about with another person. You can go to irs.gov and follow the links and enter into an installment agreement. Now, obviously, there's some restrictions and, you know, some limitations. The one to keep in mind the most is that you have to owe less than $50,000 to qualify for the installment agreement. And it's for individual taxpayers. Business taxpayers generally still have to go through the normal channels. If you don't feel comfortable doing it online, you can always call IRS and you can set something up through the phone system as well.
A lot of people file their taxes online or they do it themselves. But what's the point where it makes sense to hire somebody and pay them to help you out?
I don't think that there's a number where you say, if I owe X amount or if I make X amount, I need a tax professional. I think the most important one is your level of comfort and your time. Because if you are, for example, self-employed, you get paid when you work. If you've been spending a couple of days trying to figure out your taxes, you're not going to get paid. So there's kind of a time value of money that I think people need to take into consideration. I think people are often surprised if they've never used a preparer before to find out how inexpensive some of them can be or how economical and efficient it can be in terms of time. That said, just kind of from a practical standpoint, if things have changed in your life, I highly recommend using someone, you know, whether you've had a baby or whether you've gotten married in life events. You usually want somebody that can kind of help you get guided through the process, because it's my experience that the folks who are worried about getting their taxes done, it's generally not that they are worried about making a mistake. It's that they often are just kind of overwhelmed. And I think those people tend to under-deduct. You know, a tax preparer, they're going to look at your situation and they're going to say, you know, these are the three things that you might be able to deduct that I don't see anywhere on your financials. Let's talk about them. And I think that that can be invaluable.
there are also a lot of scams that pop up at tax time. What should you be wary of right now?
Oh, there's a bunch. This is actually a really interesting year because the IRS and the Inspector General have been working together to put the kibosh on some of these scams. And there's a couple of things to be aware of. When you hire a tax preparer, you want to make sure that they are credentialed and that they know what they're doing. The IRS still require tax preparers that prepare returns for compensation. Those folks still have to have a P10 number. It's P-T-I-N. You can think of it like a social security number for preparers. So the IRS knows who's preparing that return. Another thing to keep in mind is that if you owe taxes, if anything's gone wrong with your filing, most of the time they're going to contact you through a letter. They're not going to text you, they're not going to call you, and they're not going to email you. And a lot of these identity theft scams that are going on right now are from folks posing as representatives from the IRS. And kind of the most prevalent one right now is when IRS, allegedly, someone from the IRS, calls up folks, they're kind of targeting immigrants and the elderly in particular, and say, you owe money to us, we're going to arrest you tomorrow if you don't pay us now. And then they're asking for debit card information over the phone. Usually if the IRS calls you, it's because you've been engaged in conversations with them before and you've given them your contact information. But the IRS is also never going to threaten to arrest you over the phone. They're never going to use abusive language. Those aren't the kinds of things that the IRS would actually say.
Got it. Kelly Phillips Erb writes the blog Tax Girl and contributes to Forbes and other financial sites. Kelly, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
There are more of Kelly's tax tips at marketplacemoney.org, plus stories we've collected about filing taxes for the first time. Here's Meredith in Washington, D.C.
I did TurboTax this year, so it helped me along. In my friend group, whereas we used to bitch about relationships or work or something, it's now become taxes. And whenever someone has a tip like, oh, I got this great deduction, that's what we share. And it's not shopping victories or memorable stories from nights out.
Microsoft Windows XP is 12 years old. In tech years, which are kind of like dog years, that's about 500. And while the numbers vary as to how many of the world's PCs use the operating system, they tend to range from 15 to even 25%. That's a lot of computers. This week, Microsoft ended support of XP. So what does that mean for all those people who use it? Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
What does it mean exactly that Microsoft is ending support for Windows XP?
So it means basically that the company has moved on from this operating system and wants all of its users to update our operating systems to Windows 8 and 8.1, et cetera, et cetera. And what that means is also that the company is not going to continue sort of building fixes for this operating system, building software, security support, new patches, new bits of software that actually helps to strengthen and protect Windows XP as we all continue to use our devices.
So if you're someone who has it on a computer at home and you don't actually, you know, upgrade to the next software, are you vulnerable to viruses and things like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, Microsoft will say that. That's, you know, part of their argument for updating your software. And that is also absolutely true. It's kind of funny. There are entire governments, the UK government and the Dutch government, are actually spending millions to extend with Microsoft at least about a year of support and service for all of the machines in those governments that run XP. And so that gives you a sense of just how concerned they are about some of the vulnerabilities that might appear once Microsoft actually stops for most users offering some kind of support. So there are going to be vulnerabilities. There are some tips, I think, for users who do want to keep XP. It is a very popular operating system.
Yeah, what do you do if you've got it?
For one thing, you probably maybe should consider not using Internet Explorer, thinking about using a different browser that's going to have more updates within it. I think are going to be some security flaws in Explorer if you continue using XP and Explorer. Another thing that you should do is update your third-party software, so update other kinds of software that you might have on your computer or your device. Just make sure you keep updating that software so that, generally speaking, your device is more secure. Viewer, and also other Microsoft applications and software. It's the stuff that's, you know, you can update while still keeping XP on your computer. One other important thing that you should do, it's really good to have the best kind of antivirus software that you have. So if you can keep updating your security software and buy the best stuff, that's probably going to help you out as well.
I feel like every other day I'm getting a message from my computer and it's telling me, oh, there is a system upgrade and your iTunes is now out of date.
It is the worst, right?
Yeah,
it's
why
the
does
worst.
This always happen? I mean, is there a way to be smarter about this?
I think there is. I mean, basically with all technology, Lizzie, we want to be as engaged as we can be. We love it when a software, a piece of hardware just works perfectly for us and we don't ever have to think about the sort of back end and the complexities of that software or hardware. But as a user, it's really better for you to think about updates, to do some searches, to learn a little bit about your iOS 7 before you put it on your phone willy-nilly. You know, anybody who is in the tech world building this software, they are trying to make it better. They're trying to make it more efficient. They're trying to help users. But there's another side to that, which is, of course, you know, they can't perfectly guess all of the fixes that they would make for you. And as the user, you're going to discover some problems. So the more that you can engage with just learning about the update before you do it and soon after you do it to understand better how to interact with the update and interact with the new software that's going to be on your device, the better.
Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, thanks so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Also in the tech world, the Heartbleed mess. Should you change your passwords, like, right now? Check out all our reporting on Heartbleed at marketplace.org. Just ahead, David Lazarus offers his advice on money and relationships.
I was reading a study the other day that talked about the biggest causes for breakups, and they were money and sex.
Well, we'll help you with the money part. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Now is the point in the show where we open up the phone lines and we take your calls, give you a little money advice. And we're going to do that today with David Lazarus. He is the consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
Hello, Lizzie.
How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Good. Well, we are going to start with Celia in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Celia.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So I gather your mother is kind of the issue here. It sounds like this is a pretty long and somewhat torturous story.
Yes. She just is kind of a chronic debtor, and I'm afraid of the impact it may have on my financial future.
Tell me about what she's doing now. So she was gifted a house, essentially, but it sounds like she is not paying a lot of the bills that she ought to be paying, and in fact, some things are in your name. There's a lot of messiness going on here.
Yes, she was gifted a house, and we as in my family, just realized that she has not paid her property taxes, and there was a lien on the house.
Yikes.
So we jumped in and helped her out and to pay for her things so she didn't have to lose the house. And she's making payments the most that she can, but she doesn't make very much money. And, of course, is bad at managing her money. And then she doesn't pay her utility bills very often. And when one of my aunts was helping her with a bill, she noticed that the account number was the last four digits of my Social Security number. So the account may be in my name. I called the company. They didn't give me any information. I'm wondering what I should do to figure this out.
Yeah. You know, before I turn you over to David, I'm curious, have you confronted your mother and had sort of a heart-to-heart about this stuff?
Yes, I have. This has happened in the past. There was a phone bill that was taken out in my name that I did find out about 10 years ago. And I asked her about this, and she said, no, it's not in my name, but as a kind of a unstable person and just living this debt lifestyle, there's a lot of lies and shame, and unfortunately, I just can't believe her.
That's got to be really frustrating and sad.
Yeah, it is pretty sad, but she's, I just want to support her the best that I can and also just know the truth and figure things out the best.
How old is your mom?
She is 53.
And what kind of income does she have coming in? And do you know what the payments on the house ought to be?
Well, she is making, her take home at this point is $190 a week. She works as a cook and makes $8 an hour and gets paid every week. She's been doing that for about 2 months. Prior to that, she was unemployed for many, many, many months. Just employment, it's hard for her to find. And she's working on a payment plan right now for her property taxes where she pays $75 a week for a number of months. And then in the fall, she'll have to start that again for 2011 back taxes.
Well, you're lucky we've got David on the line because this is really sort of his area of expertise, not just the financials, but also the broader consumer issues and the impact that some of this might have on you. David, what are your thoughts for Celia?
Well, first of all, the root causes of your mother's reckless behavior are clearly an issue and clearly need to be addressed, but not here, because it sounds like that's not a personal finance issue. That's something that's going to require a doctor, a therapist, a psychologist, that's something else. But if she's in her 50s and behaving this irresponsibly, something is going on. And so as a family member, you need to be cognizant of that and you need to do what you can. I mean, you know, obviously you can't force her to do anything, but do what you can. Keep that in mind. That's the broader context. Now, the nitty-gritty for our purposes here is looking at that reckless financial behavior and what do you do about it. And the first red flag you mentioned, Celia, is your Social Security number, your, not your mother, might
right.
be in play here. And that's a big deal because if mom is abusing your social, that's a felony. That's Social Security mm-hmm. fraud. And I'm assuming you're not going to want to throw her in the hoosegow. But you do need to cover yourself. And if there's nothing else to do, I say you have to change your number. And it's a hassle because a lot of different entities have your Social Security number. They're using it as your personal ID. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not painless. But you do need to protect yourself because if mom's dipped her cup in that well once, she's going to do it again. So that's the first thing. You've got to protect yourself, okay?
Yep.
All right. After that, now we have to protect mom from herself. And the best way to do that is going to be a power of attorney. She might not be open to it, but you've got some leverage right now. If she's going to be losing her home, if she's facing destitution out on the streets, you come to her and you tell her, look, I'm not here to cause you pain. I'm not here to punish you. I'm here to keep you with a roof over your head and food on the table and protect you as you get on. And as long as you're coming from that place, she might be responsive, and you say, look, it seems clear from the evidence that you're not really handling this stuff well. I want to handle it for you. And she might respond to that because what you're doing is couching it in terms of, I want to take that burden off your shoulders. And if she does give you power of attorney, then you're in the driver's seat financially because now you can set everything up, whether it's her credit cards, whether it's her mortgage, whether it's her utility bills, and take control of these things so that you can make sure they're getting paid, so that you can make sure that her creditors are being kept happy and at bay. Now, if she won't give you power of attorney, and if she is determined to keep acting like a child, you know, it might be that you have no recourse but to treat her like a child.
Okay.
How does that sit with you, Celia?
I've been looking into things like that. I'm just kind of unsure of how I would move forward. In particular, I've tried to get a new Social Security number, but they said I would have to have lots of evidence to prove that my name was being taken and that I'd have to hire a lawyer to get that, which I would like to do, but at this point it seems a little prohibitive.
All right, what I suggest is you want to contact some consumer advocate near where you are. You're in Portland, Oregon, correct?
Yes.
All right. There's going to be a number of nonprofits that deal not just with creditors, but people who have dealt with identity theft issues. And you might want to look around for them. If that doesn't help out, down in San Diego, there's the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. They deal with some identity theft issues as well, and they might be able to get the ball rolling on the Social Security front. So look at some of the nonprofits out there, because this might not have to be an expensive road, but it will be a difficult road. And then when dealing with your mom, like I say, it's all about context. And if you come at her in as non-threatening a fashion as you can, talk about how you love her, talk about how you want to protect her, talk about how you want to make sure that she doesn't face any troubles down the road, then you've put it in a place where she might be responsive. If it sounds like you're just trying to take things away from her, she will circle her wagons instantly and become rebellious and throw a tantrum, and that's not what you want.
All right. That sounds great.
You know, you mentioned that your mother has sisters.
Yeah.
Do you feel like they are helpful allies to you in this process?
One in particular is, but the other two just feel like she is too old for this behavior and don't really want to help her anymore. But one of those sisters was the one that bought her the house. And when they bought her the house, they also gave her a lot of things that she needs to fix and pour money into, and was kind of like a burden. So I feel like they're not quite as helpful, a little bit out of it, as, you know, they could be.
Well, it might be worth trying to figure out if you could have a partner in this process, because obviously, you know, doing this stuff with a parent is really hard. It's not the role that children are traditionally in, and maybe having an ally would feel nice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you can do this? Is this advice helpful to you?
Yes, absolutely. This gives me a good place to look. I was feeling really overwhelmed before, but now I have some places to direct my energy. Thank you.
Celia, thank you so much. Will you make sure you stay in touch with us and let us know how it goes?
I will. I will do that. Thank you so much.
We're going to talk with Morgan in Denver. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right. So tell us about your finances. So you and your husband make kind of different amounts of money, and you're splitting things up financially.
Yes, we are.
I should put a big caveat in that sentence.
Yes. I make about $25,000 a year more than my husband does, and so we decided to split up our finances, each take separate bank accounts. And so I pay things like our mortgage and our utilities, and then he just cuts me a check every month for his half. So right now, I work as a web programmer, and I make about $85,000 a year. And because of the way my husband and I have split up our financials, I am now left with a pretty hefty surplus, about $1,800 a month that I can just kind of use for whatever I want. And I'm 31 years old, and I think a lot of people in my age group are faced with this conundrum now if we find ourselves in a situation where we're earning a pretty good living, is that I have a ton of debt, and I also have no savings. And so I'm trying to figure out the best way to allocate those funds against high-interest credit card debt and a rainy day fund, a cushion in the bank account, that kind of thing.
Now, I know that you've got two different kinds of debt, and it's very important to spell those out. So you've mm-hmm. got student loan debt, and about how much do you have there?
I have about $24,000, and it's all at 3.4%.
Okay. And then let's talk about the nasty kind of debt that you have.
Mm-hmm. So I have about $21,000 in credit cards. They are all maxed out.
Okay.
This was another big reason my husband and I split up our finances. He loves to spend. I'm not really inclined to. All the credit cards were in my name. And now I have this mountain that I'm trying to tackle, and he just doesn't have the means to really help me out. And, you know, it's fine. Got to do what you got to do. So about half of that credit card debt is in the 18 to 24% APR realm. And those, the finance charges are just killing me on those.
Wait a minute. I'm going to call you on one thing. You said
sure.
He loves to spend, but where did the 21 grand in credit card debt come from then? If you don't love to spend.
He likes to race cars, and he likes to buy cars and sell cars. And so a lot of that went into that hobby, which I shared with him.
Aha. Uh-huh. So a lot of that debt is debt that he ran up?
It's part of it is debt that he ran up with my consent at the time.
Okay.
I said, yeah, okay, let's go ahead and do this. And then part of it was also for a while there, he wasn't making a lot of money. And so living expenses also went on those paying utilities, paying for groceries, that kind of stuff. And then one day we wake up and, oh my God, all of our balances are massive.
What conversations have the two of you had about trying to take a bite out of some of what is a pretty scary number? And, you know, what do you say when you talk about that together?
When we discussed splitting up the financials, we sat down and realistically looked at both of our bills in separate spreadsheets. And because he makes so much less than I do, I said, look, you know, can you maintain half of the credit card minimums? And he said, honestly, I don't know if I can. I would rather make sure that I can have enough money to give you half the mortgage and half the utilities. And I said, okay, that's fair. But if I'm going to be stuck with the credit cards, then that means I get all the frequent flyer points, I get all the cash incentives, and that kind of thing. And we've kind of left it at that for now. We're only about 2 months into this experiment, mm-hmm. and he is trying to increase his earning potential, talk to his job about a raise. And I said, if this happens, you are back on the hook.
Well, let's see what David thinks. David?
Okay.
Well, there's a lot of really interesting things happening here, and I want to get in a moment to the way you two have structured your finances as if it's two single people living together. But first, mm-hmm. let's talk about your game plan. You're in your early 30s. You've got that ton of credit card debt at 18%. That's your priority right there.
Okay.
So I just want you to go on to radar lock with that thing.
Okay.
Get it out of your way. Now, if you're older, I would say you've really got to keep your eye on the retirement game, too. But right now, you've got some specific problems that need to be dealt with. So first of all, target the credit card debt. Get it out of your life. You don't want that sort of thing hanging over your head, messing up your credit score, draining your finances. You don't need that. Then worry about the student loan, which you said was at 3%. Plus some change. Remember, student loan doesn't go away. You declare bankruptcy, it doesn't go away. But at that interest level, it's more manageable. So you'll worry about that a little bit later. Okay, so that's where it is. Now, you also have to save. You mentioned that you don't have a lot of savings going on. I know it's still early in the game, but it's never too early to start thinking about the end game. And that's why you want to focus on a 401k if you have one, an IRA if you have one, a SEP IRA if you have one. You want to keep contributing to that as well. And as you bring that credit card debt down, bring your contributions to your retirement fund up. Okay?
Okay.
That's your first thing. Now let's talk about the way you two have worked things out in your life. Now, I get it. You're making a lot more money than your husband. You don't want to feel like he's just riding on your financial coattails and taking advantage of you, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, money is a thing in a lot of relationships. In fact, I was reading a study the other day that talked about the biggest causes for breakups, and they were money and sex. And so, you know, there it is. And
hey, this is a family radio show, man.
Well,
come on.
I can use the S-E-X word if we're going to talk.
And I'll
use the M-O-N-E-Y word because that's a thing. And so I get it, what you're doing there, Morgan. But here's what I want to say also. Financial trust is as important as emotional trust. And you're going to have to take some baby steps back towards reaching out a little bit and bringing things into the fold, because it's just that's part of the bedrock of two people spending their life together. And unless you're Donald Trump and you feel that prenups are a lifestyle, then you want to be thinking about how you can develop this bridge again to your partner. And my advice here, create a new account separate from these other accounts you have. And into that, you will both contribute date night money, for example, and vacation money. The things that you will be doing together and enjoying together. And then gradually, as you start wedding your finances more closely, maybe you can expand that, maybe not. But I think when you live separate but equal in a relationship when it comes to your finances, it shifts the power, it shifts the dynamic. And I think long term, even though you're feeling a lot of satisfaction and contentment right now, you might miss what's going to come down the road when you two have gone through hell and high water together and come out the other side.
That's great advice. That's very true.
You didn't know you were calling David Lazarus relationship therapist.
There, exactly.
I kind of wondered if this was going to turn into financial and personal advice.
they're often one and the same.
Yes. Okay, great.
We're sending you out into the world with a plan.
All right. I love it. I needed a plan.
Thanks a lot for calling, Morgan.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great one.
All right. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, sticker shock in the checkout lane. Why food prices are on the rise. Plus, what happens when a lesson about money goes awry?
I mean, a lot of our interactions around money were really around more sophisticated concepts with them, and sometimes more sophisticated than I should have been exposed to, perhaps, at that age. Like, my father taught me about interest when I was in fourth grade.
That's later on Marketplace Money from APM. Even if you're all done with your taxes, this is the season for spring cleaning. Organizing, if you will. Clear out the old, declutter your house, maybe, and money can work the same way. We have personal finance expert Farnoosh Torabi to give us the recipe for a productive financial spring cleaning. Welcome back to Marketplace Money.
Thank you, Lizzie, for having me.
All right, so before we dig into financial spring cleaning, I want to throw a news-related question at you. We've been hearing a lot about women's pay. The president has signed some executive orders relating to federal contractors. We have often heard this figure that women make 77 cents on the dollar. Mm-hmm. How does that gap look now in 2014? Mm-hmm. Does that hold consistent or is it narrowing?
It depends on the demographics you're looking at. If you look at millennials, for example, the gap is narrower. We see that while generally it's 70 cents on the dollar, broadly, when you're looking at men versus women, young millennials ages 20 to 34, that gap is actually smaller. It's around 93%, 93 cents for every dollar. And what's fueling that, I think, is we're looking at younger women going and getting their degrees at a faster rate than men, not just bachelor's, but master's. And then also the job market in some ways has been more favorable to women. We talked about how the recession was a man session. But there is something happening when they get older. Women are still at the forefront of domestic duties. They're the ones primarily leaving the workforce to tend to childcare because there are better provisions for them for that. And men aren't taking paternity leave. But there are a lot of forces at play.
We're going to turn now to the spring cleaning issue. So run through a mental checklist of kind of what you look at if you're going, all right,
yeah,
let me go through my spring cleaning here.
So with the theme of spring cleaning, and I just did some spring cleaning, I'm expecting a child in June. So we are all about decluttering in my house. But with the theme of, you know, decluttering, minimizing, getting organized, looking ahead, all of that applies to your finances. So I would say you want to automate your bills because that means less stress. It's minimizing your financial burdens. So automating your bills if you haven't already to make sure also that you're paying your bills on time, never get behind. Going paperless. This is something that we as a country are doing more and more of, but some of us are a little bit behind. If you're still getting some snail mail, make sure you're opting in for paperless statements through your bank, through your credit card company, any other regular bills. That will help to declutter and just give you peace of mind. I would also say now is a good time. We talked about taxes, so getting organized with your taxes and remembering that the IRS does typically audit. If the IRS does come a knocking with an audit, they will want to see the last 3 years of your records and all the supporting documents.
So thinking 3-year windows is a good way to think?
Right. The one exception is if you are somebody who, and you have to answer this honestly, if you've an underreporting income and the IRS audits you for that reason, they could go back as far as 6 years. So if you're somebody that takes a little bit of risk with your reporting, pushes the envelope, make sure you have even extra support and backup. So that would be what I would do with taxes. But then also finally, you know, spring is a time when we're looking ahead. A lot of families perhaps thinking about buying a home. People are buying cars. They're applying for loans for school. So this is a good time to get a really firm understanding of where you stand credit-wise You can do it for free every year. If you haven't already, go check your credit report on annualcreditreport.com.
And it's that's free. The free one.
And that's the free one. That's the credit report, which gives you access to your credit reports from all three of the major credit reporting agencies. You should definitely take advantage of this. It's your right. Check to see if there are any mistakes, because if there are, it could be something as small as your address is incorrect, or it could be that there's an account on there that you have no recollection of. This could ultimately impact your credit score, which is what lenders will look at when evaluating whether they're going to give you a loan and what kind of an interest rate they're going to attach to it.
You mentioned automating your bills and going paperless. A lot of people have concerns about security.
Sure.
Is all of that stuff secure, and how to keep it secure? How do you do that?
Well, you know, I think that it's about making sure that you don't just put things on automation and then in your mind go on autopilot. You still have to be checking your accounts. I would say get in the habit of checking your statements online ever so frequently. I mean, I would say I do it every day. I check my bank balance every day. I'm kind of a nerd like that. But if you don't have that propensity, at least once a month to make sure everything is accurate. Because sometimes, I mean, banks are getting more vigilant at making sure that everything is correct and there aren't any scams. But things fall through the cracks, and you're the best one to be able to judge whether or not you made that purchase or not. And timing is important. So the more active you are in checking your statements online, the more likely you can keep it from getting worse.
How can you boost your credit score? I think a lot of people wonder that.
The most important factors for boosting your credit score: one, paying your bills on time. So automation, we talked about that earlier, can really help with that. And then knocking down your debt. The credit score calculators do look at how much debt you are carrying versus the amount of credit that's been allotted to you. And it's not just enough to pay off your balance every month. It's important to pay it off as you go, because your credit score could be computed at any point during the month. It's not like they check it as soon as you pay off your balance. So if you're out there and you're maxing out your cards with the intention of paying them off at the end of the month in full, I would say go in and just start paying it off as you go throughout the month. Because if you are in the market for a loan and you know your score is going to get looked at, it's better to be paying down your debt regularly as opposed to once a month.
Farnoosh Torabi is a personal finance expert. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Lizzie.
What are your tips for financial spring cleaning? Share them with us at marketplacemoney.org or tweet us at LiveMoney. If I asked you to think about the word inflation, listeners who were around in the 1970s might recall the high prices of that era and the Whip Inflation Now campaign of Gerald Ford's White House. These days, inflation is almost non-existent in most of the goods we buy, except for a few very important things, things that families depend on every day, like eggs, meat, milk, and vegetables. Matthew Bosler is a reporter for Business Insider, and he's written about food inflation. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
On Valentine's Day, I decided that I was going to cook steak dinner for me and my boyfriend, and I went and I bought a great big steak. And I was kind of bowled over by how much it cost. It was much more than I was expecting. What is going on with the price of commodities, the price of food?
So food prices have really been surging in 2014 after a couple years sort of going down after, you know, the record prices we saw in 2011. And a lot of it is due to weather. You know, we have a big drought in California. We've had, dry conditions across the Midwest, the Great Plains regions. The extreme weather events, you know, serve to disrupt crop supplies. And so that can drive prices up. And that's what we've seen a lot of around the world. And another factor you have is sort of the financialization of these commodities markets. So it's very easy for an investor to bet on rising commodity prices. And no one ever really bets on those prices going down. So you have a lot of one-way money flowing into these markets, and they can become quickly overwhelmed because they're not designed for that.
often when we talk about food inflation, we're also talking about the growth of the middle class in places like India and China. But that does not seem to be the driving factor that's going on right now.
Right. Yeah, it's that would be like the demand side. And this is a lot of stuff that's happening on the supply side. And there are a lot of feedback loops. For example, let's say, you know, there's a drought and, you know, crops aren't getting enough rain. So there's, you know, we're not producing as much wheat or corn or whatever it is. Well, that, you know, restricts the amount of cattle you can raise because they don't have as much space to pasture the cattle. These rising prices can sort of feed into each other and everything can kind of go up at once.
What does that mean for food companies? Does that mean that they're going to end up raising their prices and then consumers are going to see prices go up on, you know, their end when they're pushing a cart down a supermarket aisle?
Yeah, that's definitely a concern for consumers, but I think companies are also sort of trying to figure out how much of that inflation they can pass through in higher prices to customers because, you know, everybody knows it's kind of sort of a soft economic environment over the last couple of years as we've been trying to recover from the recession, and there just isn't as much capacity for consumers to, you know, increase spending on food when prices go up. You know, supply and demand sort of governs the price of a commodity, but the way these markets are set up and, you know, given how much sort of capital is flowing seeking investment opportunities, the sort of the jumps in prices can be very volatile and large. If you look at how hedge funds are positioned in these markets right now, they've built up some of the biggest positions in many years. And so, you know, there's a lot of potential for that to unwind, but they definitely serve to increase volatility of these prices, and that does ultimately pass through to the consumer.
So that means that some rich guy who is buying, and it's mostly buying, right, who is buying, say, futures in the wheat market, that really impacts what somebody is paying for whatever their groceries are when they go to the supermarket.
Exactly. So that's sort of a big question, is how long will that last, you know, and how long will this money be kept in these markets?
Do we have any idea how long that's going to be?
I think it depends on, you know, the commodity. I think most investment strategists expect beef prices to stay elevated because that's sort of more of a structural story where you have had reduced crop yield in recent years, and that has sort of reduced the capacity for cattle and other livestock to, you know, feed and graze. In other commodities like wheat, for example, a lot of that could be related to geopolitical tensions in Russia and Ukraine, so that has the potential to dissipate further.
Matthew Bosler is a reporter for Business Insider. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Filing your taxes can be fun, right? Yeah, okay, not really. It's a headache. And let's face it, many of us may have waited until the last minute, but not everyone is stressing about tax time.
My parents have always taken care of it for me. I feel kind of ashamed of myself. I know that I should probably learn soon because I'm 23.
I've never done my taxes, and that is because my mom is an accountant, so I'm pretty much set. I will never have to do taxes. She does it for our whole family. So I get my W-2 form and my mom nags me to send it to her. And then I send it to her and then she sends me back the stuff with like explicit instructions. And I haven't turned them in yet. It's already April, right?
Thanks to Mark Solinger in D.C. for collecting those voices for us. And what do you think? Should everyone experience filing their own taxes at least once? Share your opinion at marketplacemoney.org or tweet us at LiveMoney.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Teaching kids how money works can be a daunting task for parents. It's easy to default to cliches like saying, it doesn't grow on trees. But even lessons with the best of intentions can result in some unexpected takeaways.
My name is Douglas Kearney. I am a poet and I teach at California Institute of the Arts in Valencia. I grew up in Altadena, California, actually. My mother worked in L.A. County. You know, she worked in the county building. My father worked for the Postal Service. I never knew how much money my parents made. I mean, a lot of our interactions around money were really around more sophisticated concepts with them, and sometimes more sophisticated than I should have been exposed to, perhaps, at that age. Like, my father taught me about interest when I was in fourth grade. I mean, literally, like, we were out, like, in the backyard. He was like, hey, I would like to borrow a dollar from you, but listen, I'm going to borrow a dollar from you, and I'm going to give you back $1.25. And I was like, wow. He's like, well, that's called interest, right? And I think he kind of thought that that would be sort of funny. I mean, I guess, you know, like nowadays, like parents give their kids mohawks or like, you know, dress them in tuxedos or whatever. And my dad was like, let me turn this guy into a banker. Wouldn't that be cute? And so I took this concept and I ran with it. So I actually would go to my school and like a kid might say, hey, can I borrow 50 cents from you? And I'd say like, yeah, but you're going to have to pay me back 75 cents. And if you don't, and I didn't know about loan sharking, but if you don't pay me back by Thursday, I'm going to double it. And then I'm going to double it again. And I would make these kids sign contracts. And I mean, it's always about convenience, right? I mean, why pay more, you know, to go to one gas station over another one? Well, this gas station's closer to you, right? So, like, if a person walks up to you and whatever they feel is urgent about getting this quarter, maybe there's another kid who's selling, like, Nerds or Jolly Ranchers or something, and that kid's standing right there. And so it's like, oh, can I get a quarter? And I'm like, okay, yeah, you can get a quarter, but you're going to have to pay me back a quarter plus a dime. And sure, not everybody went for it, but a lot more people than you might think did. So I think it was the convenience. I think they liked the professional level of the exchange because there was a contract involved. So, you know, I was providing a service. I would get from a 50-cent loan, I'd end up getting like $3 or $4. And like one day I told my dad about this and he was like, okay, you can't do that. That's illegal. And I was like, what? They signed a contract. So, I mean, that was one of the early conversations I had.
Doug Kearney's latest collection of poetry is called Patter. Visit MarketplaceMoney.org to hear him talk about tax season and, yep, how it can even inspire rhyme. That's it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time, yes, you should always be nice, but there are real benefits to not being a jerk on an airplane. Marketplace Money is produced by Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Bill Lance is our engineer. And a special thanks this week to our radio hosts, WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.